Okay, well, let us begin. Today we're going to complete, or not complete, I'm sorry, today we'll have the second of the sessions on Rabbi Reines. Next week we'll complete Rav Reines. Rav Chaim Hirschenson, we're going to have to push him off until next semester. I do want to, before we start, received another number of emails and want to clarify some things we said last time, so let's take a couple minutes. First, in the discussion of Yaffa Eliach, someone, they want to know one of you, or two of you actually, want to know the details of Sholem's criticism. Let me first say that I made a mistake. I mentioned the name Narodniki as the group, the Russian group. Narodniki actually refers to, it's the name given to these Russian revolutionaries, these young revolutionaries in the 19th century. But if I found the passage. It's in Sholem's book, The Messianic Idea in Judaism. And on page 196, he's talking about influences on Hasidut, Sabbatian influence, etc. And in his footnote, on page 362, he writes as follows. The extraordinary statements of Yaffa Eliach in this connection, maintaining that these things, when he says these things, he's referring to certain ideas that he's referring to that Hasidism has, as well as the substance of Hasidic teachings, came originally from the Russian sect of the Kilisti, are entirely without foundation. And then Sholem writes, this paper and all its hypotheses are a deplorable example of scholarly irresponsibility, leaving the reader wondering about the state of Jewish studies. So that is what Sholem has to say about Yaffa Eliach. A couple other things. I made a note to myself. I was discussing the Aliyah of Reines' grandfather, and I said that he went with Rav Menachem Mendel of Shklov. That is true, but I said that Menachem Mendel of Shklov is the author of the Peyas HaShulchan. Immediately I realized that it's actually Rav Yisroel of Shklov who's the author of the Peyas HaShulchan. I mentioned last class and the class before how Kalischer believed that you should circumcise the children of a non-Jewish mother and a Jewish father. It would make it easier to convert later on. And I pointed out that this is especially in the case in an era where we didn't have anesthesia for later conversions. So one of you asked me, is it permissible for someone converting to use anesthesia? And it absolutely is, although there was a machlokas years ago. The standard halachic position is that it is correct. There is a machlokas, however, about using general anesthesia. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Sri Deyesh hold that local anesthesia is permissible. Weinberg thought that for a baby, you could use general if for some reason you needed to, but an adult needs to be conscious because he's fulfilling the mitzvah. Rav Avadi Yosef disagrees. He holds that even an adult can have general anesthesia. I don't know what they do with the Russians who come to Israel. I'm assuming they use local. Two more points before we begin. One of you asked me about this Rabbi Yehuda Leib Feuer, who I said was a leading student of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and I described how he became rabbi of a conservative shul in Mount Holyoke, Massachusetts, and that the story or the legend is that although he remained the rabbi, he never actually entered the conservative shul and didn't daven there, but they used him to sell their chametz, etc. I actually tried to track this down a couple years ago. I put something on the H Judaic listserv. Does anyone know of anyone, or is anyone from Mount Holyoke, Massachusetts? I wanted to speak to some elderly person. Didn't get anywhere. You know, I wanted to actually determine, was this great student of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik a rabbi in a conservative shul? Every Shabbos, that is. I contacted, there's an Orthodox rabbi in Mount Holyoke, Massachusetts, and he really couldn't help me with anything. He didn't know anything. He just sent me the discussions of Feuer from a book some of you might have seen, Chachmei Yisroel of New England. So if anyone knows anyone who came from Mount Holyoke, Massachusetts, please let me know. And finally, two more things, actually, before we get to finally. Those who are interested, especially on one person who's been listening to the MP3s about the Chavetz Chaim Yeshiva that I mentioned last class, here is a book, a five-volume set series on the Chafetz Chaim's life. And in volume one, page 58, it actually describes how many people think that the Chafetz Chaim had students. And it's not true. He would come to the yeshiva, and he would sometimes speak some mussar shmuz, but that's it. He didn't have any students, and even Chanan Wasserman, who studied there, said that the Chafetz Chaim was Rabban Shel Yisrael, the great rabbi of Israel, but he never said he was his student. And by the way, this is the recollections of the Chafetz Chaim's grandson in this section of the book, the son of Rabbi Zaks, who was the bochein, that is, the tester at Yeshiva University. The Chafetz Chaim's son-in-law became a Ram, a Rebbe, not a Rosh Yeshiva officially, but he taught at YU. And this is his son speaking, and his son tells a very interesting story, which just shows you, we've spoken a bit about how the yeshiva world was so different than you think of today, how the Chafetz Chaim was at a certain place outside of town, and they needed some people to make the minyan. This was on a fast day, Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, and a group of the Bachrin from his yeshiva were there, and they announced that we haven't fasted today. I guess that they thought maybe there's a problem for them making the minyan on the fast day. And the Chafetz Chaim was all upset. You know, you hear yeshiva Bachrin, not fasting. And he spoke to the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Naftali Trupp, and he says you have to throw them out of the yeshiva. And Rav Naftali Trupp tried to keep them in the yeshiva, explain, etc., why they should remain in the yeshiva. And the only thing they kept them in was when Rav Zaks, which Simcha says they took tests for him, he came to the Chafetz Chaim and said that if you force them to leave the yeshiva, they're going to go to this Mizrahi yeshiva. That's Rav Reines' yeshiva that we'll speak about today. And when the Chafetz Chaim heard that, he allowed them to stay. But the idea that you have yeshiva bachrim and a great yeshiva like the Radin Yeshiva who weren't fasting, we know other stories how yeshiva bachrim were shaving with razors. The Nitziv used to go up to yeshiva bachrim, we have in the memoir literature, and feel their faces to see if they were shaving with razors. It's unimaginable today to imagine that yeshiva bachrim will be doing this. But as we've mentioned so many times, in those days, you had many people in yeshivas. It's not like today where if you don't want to be in the yeshiva, you go to the university. You had all sorts of maskilim there, people who were there for all sorts of reasons, who were intellectuals, but weren't the most pious. Finally, I want to answer a question that we spoke about months ago because I just found an answer over Shabbos. I was reading from a sefer called, what's the sefer's name again? Ma'orei Or, yes, the Ma'orei Or. It's written by Rav Aryeh Leib of Worms. He was the chief rabbi of Metz. I'll speak about him more in a minute. Those who are interested, Jay Berkovitz, a professor at University of Massachusetts, has written a book dealing with him and a long article. He writes in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch, these volumes, it's about six volumes of the Ma'orei Or. For a long time, they were collector's items. But about 10 years ago, they were reprinted, and they're on all the various websites. He writes in discussing how it's not a halacha that you have to wear a kippah. It's only a minhag. And we spoke about this with regard to the German Orthodox practice. And Metz is, although today it's in France, it was in the German sphere of influence. After proving that it's not a halacha, he says that, let me read you the language he uses. He says, Nafkamina tuva be'ezet tzorach. And the fact that it's not a halacha is valuable. It's important because there might be a necessity that you don't wear a kippah. And then he gives an example for bracha overis karanim. If you hear thunder, that was the question one of you asked. Let's say you're in the pool and you hear thunder. Can you make the bracha? And he says absolutely make the bracha because there's no obligation to wear a yarmulke. And then he says makol kein kishemachasa b'yado. He says and especially you can cover your head with your hand if you need to. Now I'll just mention why does that, some of you might have heard of the Ma'orei Or. I guarantee you no one heard of the Ma'orei Or unless you're a big Talmud Chacham 15 years ago. He's quoted in various Sfarim. He's quoted in all the Bekiyas, the type of Sfarim, even the Minchas Elazar quotes him and others. Why is he well known? He's well known because someone, it wasn't Jay Berkovitz, someone discovered that in the Me'orei Or, in the passage dealing with Birkos HaShachar, he says that when you recite the passage mentioning Shalos HaNegoi and Shalos HaNeisha, you should say those quietly so as not to offend the Gentiles or the women. It's the second part, which is often quoted. The feminists got hold of this, and this then became, plug it into the internet. I'm sure you'll get a number of hits. In fact, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl in the last volume of his B'nai Vanim, the very first response, or they get offended, and he shows that really there's no, there's, if you look in the sources, the reason for the bracha is for mitzvahs, that men have more mitzvahs than women. However, he says there are people who are offended. He quotes the Me'orei Or, he says you can rely on the Me'orei, the minhag in some shuls, to actually not say any Birkas HaShachar, because if you just leave one out, people, I guess, will understand what you're doing. The whole thing bothers me, but, you know, we're leaving out brachas. In any event, for those who want more details, you can see Rabbi Yankin, who quotes it. I personally don't know why, if... You know, you're offended by it. You could read it, I think, in a positive way. You could, rather than a shul getting rid of it, there's early Sidurian that have it in a positive sense. In fact, I'm holding now a copy of a Sidur from 15th century Italy, and the bracha reads as follows. The woman says this bracha, Sh'asitani ish shetono, that's not found in the Talmud, and Ashkenazim have the practice of using Shem Hashem. I don't see what would be the problem. In Italy, they did it. So, in any event, that's the Me'orei Or, that answers the question. Let us now turn to back to Rav Reines. We mentioned last class that in Shvinetzian, he began to look at the problems confronting Russian Jewry, how Torah study fell so low, and how the rabbinate fell so low, and how to change things. Reines concludes we need to train rabbis differently. And we ended last class by me mentioning that this would be very controversial because the rabbinic elite never wants any changes. Anytime you have changes, it has to come from, I wouldn't say the lay people historically, but the rabbis, not the leaders, but the younger rabbis. In fact, I think if any of you listened to the debate that we mentioned, the Hechshad Tzedek, Rabbi Shafran said that change will only come if the Gdolim want it. But historically, that's not been the way change has come. Now, Reines doesn't tell us exactly what changes he wants to do. We do know that many people opposed his changes. He really spoke in generalities, but so much so that some informers brought charges to the government against Reines, and he was put in jail, and he remained in jail for about a day and a half before the government realized they had nothing to charge him. Presumably, these informers understood that what Reines was referring to was that when he opened up this institute he was speaking about, there would be secular studies. And I believe that's correct. In addition, I think we can see from his later writings, that we'll speak about in a minute, there would be a different approach to the study of Talmud. He was able to get some people to agree in principle. For example, the Netziv thought that such an institution, that is an institution for rabbis, for future rabbis, would be a very good thing. He thought that this institution should be placed next to the Volozhin Yeshiva. Remember, Volozhin was a yeshiva. It did not train rabbis. The problem was that people sat and learnt for 10 years, let's say, and then they went out, they became a rabbi, they knew nothing about being a rabbi. What the Netziv had in mind, I have no doubt, was to establish an institute where you focused on practical halakha. The big problem in the Lithuanian yeshivas was they got no training in practical halakha. Some would study a bit before they became a rabbi, but they didn't know how to paskin. They weren't experts in pesach. In fact, the Slobodka yeshiva later opened up a special institute, I guess you can call it, to sit and learn Psak. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky studied in this place. Okay, let's stop for a minute. Technical support. Technical support, are you, is everything okay from your end? Let me keep going. Is it still a little choppy? More than a little choppy. So
I had it in and out, but it was otherwise okay.
Okay. It could be... it sounds fine for a number of people, so we're going to continue. Can I get some other people to tell us if it's fine for them?
Can technical support sort of let us know what's happening, please?
Yeah. Okay, it sounds fine now. Okay, I'll speak a little slower. We shouldn't have a problem. We only have 24, but... send us a note. Send a note at the bottom if we freeze up again. Okay, it could just come and go. As I said, there was a need. I'm gonna. It seems that about maybe 1/3 of you are having problems, sporadic. So I'm gonna have to. Go forward. Hopefully it'll be improved. It's not a perfect technology. But if it completely freezes again, please send a note at the bottom. As I said, the Netziv was interested in a place where they would study practical halakha. But Linus, based upon what we see later, was obviously thinking much bigger. Nothing came of this early idea, though. Linus thought very big, though. He saw, as we mentioned last class, a world in crisis. Okay, I've stopped. Simcha, you can't hear me? Can people send in? Okay. Okay, we... Okay, I'm going to have to go on. Sometimes it happens. We don't know why. In some places, it's choppy. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to go on. Unfortunately, for those who can't get it completely, you can always download it later, but many people are hearing it. It's hard to say why. It could be why it's happening in more than one place. But we'll go on. As I mentioned, Reines saw a world in which traditional Judaism is threatened, and he thought he has the means to stop the tide of defections. How is he going to do this? A new approach to the study of Talmud. One focused more on pshat, one which is more logical, one which could intelligently explain Agadah. In fact, this, for those who know a bit about Rav Soloveitchik's descriptions of his grandfather, this should ring a lot of bells. And we'll get back to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik in a few minutes. Reines thinks, that the rejection of traditional Judaism is due to curricular failings. That we can stop the defections from traditional Judaism by presenting a new approach to the study of Talmud. Let us see what he had in mind. His first book is And as we know from his descriptions, because the book was never published and it was lost, he applies a new logical method to Talmud study. He believed that the Talmudic sages had certain principles on how to interpret the oral law. Anyone knows who studies Gemara, sometimes you can't make heads or tails. Like, why do they say this? I mean, they could just easily have said something else. He believed that these principles are based on logic and go across the entire Talmud. That basic logical principles, the way the rabbis interpret something in one tractate, apply throughout the Talmud. And he uses all sorts of philosophical concepts to explain this. Remember, he studied Maimonides' book on logic. He tells us it took him 20 years to complete this book, although it was never published for financial reasons, presumably, and is now lost. But sections of it appear in a later book called Chotam Tachnit, which is a famous book of Rabbi Reines. Now, some people were very impressed by this book. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer wrote a positive review of it. And in fact, Reines was very proud of his ideas. He thought that they would revolutionize the study of Talmud. He wrote that there's no other book in the world like it. And years later, he looked back and acknowledged that he had what he terms Ruach Yetera, the Gava Nifraza, that is a haughty spirit and a lot of ego, I guess you could say, haughtiness. He has some shirmiyah. What did he want to do in this book? Again, he wanted to show a logical order to Talmudic reasoning and that the back-and-forth argumentation was not some random approach and it wasn't a random collection of halachot, but it was not accepted in the yeshivas. In other words, he was trying to apply logical thinking to what I think everyone acknowledges is very much what we would call maybe discursive. Neusner has written a lot about this, that the and he also tries to show that there's some sort of logical order, but not from philosophical concepts. I think most people who learn Gemara will see that it sort of goes off in tangents and everything is more ad hoc, but Reines thought differently. His approach was not accepted in the yeshivas. It was too much of a departure from the traditional way of study. Had Reines been a Rosh Yeshiva at one of the great yeshivas, it might have taken on. Look at Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's approach. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had many Talmidim, many students, and this could have given his approach entree. But there was no way that a book alone was going to create a revolution in Talmud study. The book was reprinted one time in 1934 and is never studied. What he tries to do is he tries to show, use philosophy, philosophical symbols, not symbols, methods of logic to try to show, take a Talmudic argument, take a viewpoint, for example, how what one rabbi holds, why this is muktzah, and try to create a theoretical, for next class I'll try to give you some examples, a theoretical understanding, and then try to show how in kashrus the same logical approach applies. Instead of interpreting it through the sugya itself, through the idea itself from a Talmudic approach, try to show logically, philosophically, what various possible, that's one of the problems. Who ever heard of a Talmudic approach where you put forth postulates and introductions and I'll give some examples next class. Not to say Hellenism, but philosophy. We have, I'll show you this in a second. Geula Bat Yehuda in her book gives some details of his philosophical terminology, etc., and how it's very much a departure from traditional terminology. For next class, I'll try to give you some examples. I didn't want to because they go into such detail, but really to make it more tangible, I'll give some examples. In fact, the late Rav Shilo Raphael, who's Geula Bat Yehuda's son, he passed away, he was an abbot in Jerusalem, he has a chapter in this book dealing with halacha. I'm not going to say it's like Rav Shimon Shkop. Rav Shimon Shkop is more traditional. I'll give some examples next class. In fact, the book is followed by another book, Orim Gedolim, in which he continues along this path. And to give you some example of the response of the Torah world to it, I just want to read you what the Netziv wrote about this. The Netziv has this book, Meshiv Davar. It's famous. It's the Netziv's volume of Tshuvot. except that about 15 years ago, a new edition was published, and they have volume 4 in here, published from manuscript. And what I read you now, Schneer Lyman commented that this is harsher than anything I published, you know, what Rabbi Yaakov Weinberger wrote about. And, of course, I was attacked for publishing from manuscript, an attack against, and it's not even a personal attack, but what's thought to be strong words. And here you're going to see the Netziv's attack against a Gadol B'Yisrael, Rav Reines, and it appears, and no one gets upset or no one says anything. The difference, of course, is that Reines is a religious Zionist, so he could be attacked. The family is very Haredi now. They censor a lot of the Netziv's writings, but this is not something, had this letter been to someone from the traditional yeshiva world, it never would have appeared. Those who are interested in learning about the family and how they've censored and the difficulty in writing about the Netziv, I call your attention first to Gil Pearl's doctorate on the Netziv, but even better, if you go to the YU website, you can hear a lecture, a wonderful lecture by Gil Pearl on how he came to write about the Netziv and his dealings with the family. He has a PhD on the Netziv from Harvard. Now, in Volume 4, Siman 44, there's number 44, you have a letter from the Netziv to Rabbi Reines, thanking him for, well, saying that I received your book, Orim Gedolim, and he says, I looked at it a few hours, and I'm not embarrassed to say that I did not understand it. I didn't understand Koshi Hamilo to Ryanot to Dakot. I couldn't understand the words and the ideas. In order to understand this, you need to have background in logic and in philosophy. He's using words like Nimtza versus Matsoi. You know, what does that mean, Nimtza versus Matsoi, that sort of thing? So these are not part of the traditional terminology. He uses words from the Mor Nevuchim, those sort of things. Then he says, I will not refrain from telling you that if I believe that you were able to create a new method of study in the Havayot HaTalmud and Hegyona and the logic of the Talmud and in the method of study, it would be an obligation for me to fast 40 days to forget everything I have learned up until now and to sit before you to receive this new method which will enlighten the darkness of the Talmud. And he says, Uchadai Hayeta Taratenu Akdosha Lazeh. It's worth it for me to forget everything I've learned to learn, study under you. And he says, I've also seen what you wrote in your Sefer Chotam Tavnit. And I also see that this is also a mistaken Sefer. And then he points out an error, and he goes on and on. And he says that I know that you do not have the strength to create a new path in the Talmud. And he says, your Sfarim were not created for people like us who have studied in the traditional approach. And your works have only been created for those Gvirim, those, I guess, those rich people who want to show that they know something and haven't been Omel, haven't been worked in Torah study. And he goes on and on and on. He says, before those people, the Amoratzim, your books will be very valuable. But before us, they're not going to be valuable at all, etc., etc. I mean, it's an incredibly, and he ends it on your friend, and he begins it, Yedidi Harav HaGaon. But the middle, he basically blasts Reines that you've wasted your time, you're trying to come up with some new approach, and it's meaningless. Reines was to have much more success, however, in his educational program. Let me just say briefly, though, that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik also had a new approach to Talmud study, and he was attacked in words just as strong. I mentioned a few times the Ritzbaz of Slutsk, then of Chicago, and of Tzfat. He says horrible stuff about Rav Chaim's method. He even has his sons. He has an ethical will that they cannot study. It's better to study with without a Rosh Hashiva than to have a Rosh Hashiva who studies in accordance with what he calls the chemical method. The Marcheshas attacks it. This was a new method as well. The Chazon Ish also attacks it. Yes, Yisrael says chemistry. They call it, he calls it chemia. The Ritvaz attacks it in two places, very harshly. In fact, I know from someone who was there, Rav Harlap of YU, that the Rav was very strong against the Ritvaz. The Rav said as follows, that there are some Gedolim who are always right, there are some Gedolim who are sometimes right, and there are some Gedolim who are never right, and the Ritvaz is never right. The Ritvaz was the great attacker of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and Rav Harlap told me a story that when a certain student quoted the Ritvaz, the Rav started screaming as the way that only the Rav could do, don't ever quote the Ritvaz. I mention all this. It's interesting that Stamfer, in his book on yeshivas in Lithuania, the first edition, published in 1995, he quotes what the Ritvaz says, all the strong stuff against don't study this method, which has now become very popular, and people are studying it, keep away from it. And he quotes Shaul Lieberman as saying that the Ritvaz was writing against Rhinus. Now, this was, of course, entirely incorrect. First of all, Rhinus's approach never had any success. And the Ritvaz is speaking about an approach that was very successful, and he says, it's taken over the entire Lithuania, number one. Number two, the Soloveitchik family is well aware that this is what the Ritvaz has in mind, and no one before Lieberman came about said that this had anything to do with Rhinus. Rhinus's approach, as I said, had no significance. No one studied in accordance with this. So I told this to Stamfer, and if you look in the new edition of his work that just came out 2 years ago, he's taken out this whole piece from Rhinus, and now dealing with Rhinus and Lieberman, and correctly points out that this is against Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and there's a number of others who could be quoted. In fact, in my last book on the Rambam, I found a source that, as far as I know, no one's ever referred to, Rav Yaakov Avigdor. He happened to be the one I mentioned, or Rav Moshe Feinstein said about in Mexico City, the restaurant serving treif and milk and meat together. That was the Machaber, who's also mentioned a great deal in Farbstein's book on Jewish religious life during the Holocaust. He later comes to America and then Mexico. If any of you are from Connecticut, you might know his son. I don't know if he's still alive, his son even, Rabbi Avigdor of Rav in West Hartford, Connecticut. But he has about a 30-page attack on the Brisker method. This book, incidentally, which is, they've been translating it forever, it's supposed to be published by Litman Library, that is Stamfer's book on the Lithuanian yeshivas. They needed a second edition because of information that came out after the Iron Curtain fell. The first edition describes the Volozhin yeshiva and why the Volozhin yeshiva closed because of secular studies. That's the standard answer, that the Netziv, the Russian government insisted on secular studies, and the Tziv didn't want to put it in, at least significant secular studies. Therefore, the yeshiva was closed. Now we know from Russian documents, in Russian, from the secret police documents, that that wasn't the reason. That was the reason given. But the real reason was because the yeshiva was in turmoil. It's not just today, like in the Ponovezh yeshiva, where people are fighting and throwing kugel at each other and rebelling against the various Rosh Yeshiva. The Volozhin Yeshiva, the Netziv tried to put his son, Chaim Berlin, in as Rosh Yeshiva, and the students rebelled. They didn't think Chaim Berlin was enough of a Talmud Chacham, and they went on strikes, and they interrupted him, they wouldn't let him speak, all sorts of stuff. In fact, one of the memoirs describes how Chaim Berlin was giving a shiur, and they wouldn't let him, the first word he speaks, they start throwing kashas at him, and they wouldn't let him get through the shiur without embarrassing him by asking him all these questions, showing that he was not up to snuff. But the yeshiva became a center of all of Jewish revolutionary activity, you could say, not in a communist sense, but there was no order going on. And the secret police was getting reports that the chaos in the yeshiva, and they didn't want this. And they never required any other yeshivas to put in secular studies, but this was a way of putting some order into the yeshiva. And the real reason the yeshiva was closed was because the government didn't want to, was not going to tolerate revolutionary activities going on in a yeshiva. That is, where students were getting riled up, were revolting against the leadership The Rosh Yeshiva, we see similar things in Tells, where there were revolutionary type of things going on. That's the reason. So Stanford needed to publish the book to reflect that the real reason the yeshiva was closed was because the yeshiva students themselves led to the yeshiva being closed by their activities, their rebellion, and they're trying to destroy the order in the yeshiva. Does Reiners permit women not to cover their hair? He never discussed it, as far as I know. I don't think anyone in you didn't have people in the 1870s Lithuania. The people were women there were covering their hair. You didn't. So I don't know if you heard anything. I certainly didn't. No, the rabbi from Hartford. No, you're thinking of a different rabbi from Hartford. You're thinking of Yad Halevi. It's a big sefer on Sefer HaMitzvos, where he has that long passage about this. And you should know, incidentally, that Rav Soloveitchik held very much from the Yad Halevi. He thought he was one of the Gedol Yisrael. And Rav Soloveitchik actually held of this himself. He held that the Yad Halevi's pshat was the correct pshat, that women didn't have to cover their hair in modern times based on the Yad Halevi. And he quoted it. And someone told me that Rav Lichtenstein said that was only in his early years, but in his later years, he changed his mind on that. But I don't believe that's the case, because Rakefet spoke to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein about it, and Rav Aaron, not only did he not say that, he told him, Shilas, he asked the Rav, Rav Lichtenstein then asked the Rav, then why do women need to cover their hair in shul when they go to shul if they're married? That's the minhag. And the Rav said it's Kedusha Samakum. He gave some whole thing. But in any event, the Rav held of this Yad Halevi, that's Rabbi Hurwitz, from his son was a professor at Columbia, incidentally, of international relations, Hurewitz. That's the famous Limud Schutto of the Rav of Hartford. I'm talking about a rabbi who I knew, because I lived in West Hartford, Rabbi Isaac Avigdor, who still had a shul when I lived there in 96, and his father was Rav Yaakov Avigdor, the big Rav. When I say Rav Soloveitchik, I mean the Rav. No, the Rav never wrote this down, but he said it in Shir. If you email me, I'll give you, Rakefet has two a shiurim in which he speaks about the Rav's position. Of course, Rakefet prefaces by saying that he holds what the Rav says doesn't apply anymore today when women walk around half naked, etc., etc. But he explains the Rav's position. He explains Rav Lichtenstein, who disagreed very much with the Rav, etc., etc. But it is not in print. It's not in print. And this is the first I heard of that, by the way. I know the Rav would always tell his students when they asked him this, he would always say that, because his own wife didn't cover her hair, he would always say that if you find a good woman, you don't need to be concerned with that. And as we've spoken about in many classes, you had many Lithuanian, the typical Lithuanian Rebbetzin in America didn't cover her hair. But other than a report by Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, who I don't think I don't know if you can really rely on him, in which he says a tape of Rakefet, which is a tape just of last year, in which he describes the Rav's position, and he describes Rav Lichtenstein, where Rav Lichtenstein asked the Rav. I had never seen it in print, and I had never heard it described as an actual halachic position, rather than a limud schut. I heard from Rabbi Broid that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik held this, but again, you can't really believe all these rumors. But you do have it. The Yad Halevi is a Lithuanian Rav, and his sefer was controversial. Rabbi Eliel Klatskin wrote against it. But that's the Rav of Hartford. And if we have classes on American Orthodoxy, we can speak a bit about him. Okay, returning to Reines, he had more success in his yeshiva. He concluded that the way to fight Haskalah, the way to fight the maskilim, is to become maskilim. That is, instead of fighting irreligiosity by saying that secular studies are forbidden, it's time to grasp the bull by the horns and affirm the value of secular studies and bring them into the Torah world. The Orthodox opposition to secular studies, to careers, that sort of thing, was driving people away from tradition. The rabbinic elite was telling people that they basically have a choice. You could be a white collar professional and leave Judaism, or you can be a merchant, a tailor, something like that, and be completely ignorant to the wider world. There's no middle ground. Remember, it was this type of mentality that Hirsch fought against. Hirsch's great idea was to show that it's not a question of being a blue-collar, out of mainstream, not, lack of secular education, or to be religious. He said you could have all of them. And for the rabbis to make the case that in order to be religious, you have to be separate from the world, you can't be involved with it, you can't have a degree, you can't have what today we would call a profession, that's a disaster and that's a complete distortion of Judaism. Reinus had the exact same position. But of course, when Hirsch was saying this in Germany in the 19th century, the people were ready for it. When Reinus is saying this in Eastern Europe, where the Jews are not really part of the Western of the world. Remember, in Western Europe, the world, the outside world, advanced society was beckoning for the Jews. They were giving them the opportunity to come in. The Jews just had to take that step. In Eastern Europe, Russian society wasn't opening themselves up, but Reinus believed, nevertheless, they had to take this step. Much like Rav Kook spoke about the value of the physical, Rav Kook focused on another problem, that in Eastern Europe, Judaism became detached from the physical. Judaism became entirely spiritual, and yet that's not how Jews are supposed to live. Although Rav Kook thought that in the Golos, that's how Jews live. When they go back to the land of Israel, you need to synthesize the physical and the spiritual to create a new Eretz Yisrael Jew. And this Eretz Yisrael Jew is living the way Jews are supposed to live, like they lived in the days of the Temple. That is where you have both the spiritual and the physical. Reinus, he didn't wait till you go to the land of Israel. He said that Jews have to be involved in both spiritual and physical. He says you need Shleimus HaGuf in order to have Shleimus HaNefesh. That is, you need to have strong bodies to have strong souls. He wrote about how the true Jewish education is designed to bring about a desire, a love for the spiritual. But this doesn't mean that we suppress the physical. We don't need to tell people that being a Jew is just sitting in a base medrash all day and study. That you don't need to be concerned about the physical body. You don't need to be concerned not just physical, your personal physical body, which is one thing, but the physical world, what's out there. That is to be a complete person. Basically, Reinus is going to strive to create a complete Jew, much like Hirsch did in Germany and much like Rav Kook was trying to do in the land of Israel. Remember, the East European mentality, Judaism, the Jew, is entirely removed from everything that's not Jewishly particular. So in his yeshiva, that is in the little yeshiva he opened up in Shvenetzion, there were secular studies. He opened a little yeshiva there, and there were secular studies. And this was very radical, because it changed the structure of the yeshiva. You have people like the Netziv. The Netziv was not opposed to secular studies. He writes about it in the Emek Dovar. I published a letter he wrote. He thought secular studies were very valuable, but not in the yeshiva. To put secular studies in the yeshiva is to distort the yeshiva. It is true, and this is what J.J. Schachter's article, famous article, is about, that when it was a choice between putting them in the yeshiva or closing down the yeshiva, he put secular studies in, very basic secular studies. When the Russian government demanded more significant secular studies, which would really change the nature of the yeshiva, he refused, and the yeshiva was shut down. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, now we know that it wasn't that the Russian government really was interested in creating some sort of yeshiva university in Volozhin, but this was their way. They knew that the Netziv would be forced to close the yeshiva, and they wanted to close the yeshiva down, so this was the excuse. Okay. Incidentally, Reinus even wrote about the need to educate girls in spiritual things. When Reinus wrote this, girls received absolutely no education. They were only educated in practical, I guess, home economics type stuff. Reinus writes in the 1870s that we need to educate girls. The Beis Yaakov movement won't get started for another 40 years. Reinus is really ahead of his time, but he doesn't do anything about this. He doesn't try to advance this objective. His major focus was on the men, training men. I guess he thought that was more important. He wanted to spread this idea among the rabbis. And in 1882, there was a great rabbinic convention in St. Petersburg, and Reines goes there. Who was at this convention? Well, you had Rav Yosef Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi was there. You had Rav Yitzchak Hanan Spector, or the great, great rabbis of the time. The Beis Halevi, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, is the father of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who we mentioned before, who was a Rosh Yeshiva Volozhin, together with the Nesiv. The Beis Halevi was also a Rosh Yeshiva at Volozhin until he and the Nesiv had a falling out, had a machokas. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, as I said, was the founder of this new method of Talmud study. In fact, I'll tell you an interesting story about the Nesiv, about Rav Chaim and his father, which illustrates a bit how the older generation thought about Rav Chaim's method of Talmud study. The Beis Halevi used to say, incidentally, that he was born before Matan Torah. He was born before the giving of the Torah. That is, the giving of the Torah, when Rav Chaim Soloveitchik comes along with his new method, there's a completely new Torah. And the Beis Halevi said, you know, we learn in the old-fashioned way. But the Beis Halevi said to Rav Chaim once, he said, when someone has a question on a Tosos, let's say, or anything, on a Rambam, a good kasha, they're happy because they have a good kasha. And when I answer it properly, they're also happy because I've given a good answer. He says, when they go to you, no one's happy. Not the questioner and not you, I guess you could say. Why? Because you, Reb Chaim, show them that their question was never a question in the first place, and therefore there never was any need for an answer. Because what Reb Chaim would do would be completely reconstruct our understanding, so there really is no question, no kasha, no need for an answer. In fact, they're the Raivad. Before Reb Chaim, everyone spent their time answering the Raivad's questions on the Rambam. The Raivad has all sorts of difficulties on the Rambam. Reb Chaim comes along, and he doesn't answer the Raivad's questions. He simply shows that the Raivad had a different understanding of the Talmud, therefore he's led to this answer, and the Rambam had a different understanding, so he's led to this answer, so there's no question, there's no need to answer anything, because both their positions are coherent, they just arrive out of a different understanding, a different approach to how to view the sugya. So it's a very different method. Now, Reines goes to this convention, and he has the courage, or some would say the temerity, the nerve, to speak at the convention and tell these old rabbis how the world is very different today than it was in their youth, the way they remembered it, and the yeshivas must change. If the yeshivas do not change, they are going to lose the young generation. We've heard this so many times. How many generations have we heard that the rabbis saying we must change the yeshivas? You won't be surprised if I tell you that the response of the rabbis, the old-time rabbis, was entirely negative. Now, Reines is not the only person putting forth ideas like this. You had other rabbis, but the other rabbis, when they heard what the Gedolim said, they, as the Talmudic expression, they received schar al haprisha. That is, other rabbis had different opinions, but when they heard what the great rabbis said, they went along with the Gedolim. Rav Reines, though, he was convinced that, you know, if it was a halachic matter, he would listen to the Gedolim. But in this matter, he was sure that the Gedolim were sheltered. They didn't know what was going on in the world. These are elderly people who don't know the vernacular. They don't see what's going on. And that he understood, well, why do you listen to the Gedolim if it's a question of halacha? Because the Gedolim know more than you. But Reines thought that he knew in this area more than the Gedolim, because he was in the front lines, and he saw that the younger generation was completely leaving Judaism. So he didn't give up his idea. On the contrary, he comes back and affirms his idea, and has his yeshiva with secular studies. He even pointed out that his yeshiva is not only about training Talmudic scholars. That's what the yeshivas, the Volozhin yeshiva, and the later yeshivas are about. He points out, and this we see here, this is a model for today, that his yeshiva is also creating balabatim. Yes, people, very famous people, did go to the yeshiva, but not in Shvenetzin, in Lida, that we'll speak about soon. In fact, the Meitzer Eloi was a Rosh Yeshiva in Rav Reines' yeshiva in Lida. We'll get back to that. He says that his yeshiva is not just to train rabbis or great Talmudic scholars, but balabatim. Where is there training for a balabas? There isn't. In the traditional Lithuanian model, everyone, after finishing cheder, would go and get a job. At 13, they'd become an apprentice, and then they'd have a career by 15, 16, and then they'd get married. The elites, the few and the far between, would go off to yeshivas. And primarily, the children of rabbis and the rich people would send them, and were tiny numbers. Think in the Volozhin Yeshiva. How many were in Volozhin Yeshiva? 500? How many were in Mir? 300? Those are the only people studying in yeshivas before the other yeshivas opened. Reines says, what about the Balabatim? His yeshiva is going to train people who sit and study for a few years and then go out and become merchants and careers. So you have Talmidei Chachamim who are having careers. Isn't this what Ner Yisrael does? Isn't this what YU's been doing for generations? People who know how to learn, who go to Shiurim, and yet have careers. Torah in motion, etc. We take this all for granted, but this wasn't taken for granted. Yes, they had Shiurim, so the ignorant people would go, they did the Tefillin Zuggers, they'd read Tehillim Zuggers, and then you'd have a Shir and maybe Ein Yaakov. But serious learning, which I said, as I said, we take it for granted now that we go to yeshiva high schools, and then we go to Israel, and many of us go to YU, so by the time we go out and get a career, we've had 5 or 6 years of serious learning. But think back 40 years ago, when you didn't have yeshiva high schools for a lot of people, or 50 years ago, and people didn't go to YU, most modern Orthodox Jews were ignorant. Think back to 2 generations ago, Reines saw this, and he was the first one to speak about educating Balabatim on high level. Hirsch never did this. Hirsch's school was like a Ramaz. They had very little Talmud study. I say Ramaz because if you look at the curriculum of Ramaz, they don't have much Talmud study. You get a little of this, a little of that. It's not like where I went to high school, JC, where the whole morning is Gemara. Reines is really the only one speaking about high advanced Talmudic studies for Balabatim. Yeah, Chevra Mishnayos. But this is not learning in the sense... You had someone read a Mishnayos, and people sit back and they listen. It's almost like Daf Yomi today. I don't want to get people upset, but I think that these people who tell they're very proud, and I'm not taking away. They should be proud, I guess. People who finish Shas, because they sat for 7 years, and they heard Daf Yomi, but really that's passive. They heard. Someone who did 2 masechtas on their own really has achieved more than Daf Yomi, because there's a difference between learning, active involvement of study with a chavrus or by yourself, and passively getting it in. So the Chevra Mishnayos is really more passive learning, just like Daf Yomi's passive learning. That's not Reines' yeshiva. Reines' yeshiva is a real yeshiva. Now, what you're speaking about, I think, is you have this new thing, the smicha, the online smicha, where Balabatim on their own can study it. I know people who've studied this. I forget, Pirchei Shoshanim, where you study on your own. Now when you have, I know when I lived in Manhattan, the Lakewood Kollel had program for Balabatim. You commit for like 3 nights a week for 2-3 hours, and there's a real Seder, and you really achieve things. But this is all new. This is all the last few years. Reines was talking about this before anyone was doing it. I think the difference is, though, the people in Lakewood, they're not being trained as Balabatim. They're not being trained to sit there for a few years and then go out. Hopefully they'll become Gadol Yisrael, and I think they, out of, when they have no choice, they then become Balabatim. The Ner Yisrael model is, I think, more of the model where it's understood. Maybe today you're going to say, everyone knows they're going to be Balabatim. Okay, you know what, Yisrael? I basically accept what you're saying, because 98% of the people there know they're not going to be the next Rosh Yeshiva, and they know they're going to be Balabatim. But I don't think they don't get any real training while they're there. There's no sense while they're there. But you're right. You're right. Today, I think all the yeshivas in America, at least, have the Reines model that we're training Balabatim. The only difference is, I think a place like Ner Yisrael, while you're a bacher, you know that you're a balabas. But I think in Lakewood, maybe you don't have that sense, for good or for bad. I don't know. But I you are correct. I guess you'd say in America today, the Reines model is working. This was controversial. Some Kanaim again had him put in jail on trumped-up charges. He was in jail twice. And he was forced to close his yeshiva in 1883. It was only open a little more than 1 year. And the conflict was taking its toll. He couldn't raise money for the yeshiva. He couldn't raise money to keep it open. And in Ein Kemach, Ein Torah. As I said, for those who were not on at the beginning of the show, Jerusalem Post is reporting today from sources that more than $100 million, JTA reported earlier today that sources are saying YU has lost $100 million, and the Jerusalem Post is quoting Yeshiva University sources that it's significantly more than $100 million. This will all come out, obviously, in the next few days. We'll see if this is exaggeration or not. This is going to have enormous implications. And so, in Ein Kemach Ein Torah, we'll see what YU is going to do. So, Reines has to close his yeshiva. 300 to 500 million, who knows? And what about the people who are on the board, the rich people? We will see. This is not the end of his educational vision, however. In spring of 1884, he takes the rabbinate of Lida. Lida is a decent-sized town, even maybe a little bit of a city, which is near Vilna, and here he's able to revive his vision of a yeshiva with secular studies. And it's here, and we'll talk about this next class, we'll devote next class a lot of it, that his religious Zionist vision comes to the fore. During his time in Lida, which he spent to the rest of his life, he died right during World War One. He focused on his town. He had options to go other places. He didn't take them. One of the options was Manchester, incidentally. He even travels to Manchester and spends a few months there, but decides to go back to Lida. It's also here, as I said, that he focuses on his Zionist activities. Not Chovav Eitz Zion. Not love of the land of Israel and settlement there of the sort that Kalischer was speaking about, but political Zionism, which means a Zionist movement, which means non-religious Jews. We'll get to that next class. Already from his early years in Lida, we see how different his approach is from Rav Kook's approach. How different his approach is from what becomes religious Zionism post-67, the Rav Kook model, and even American religious Zionism, and what he founds the Mizrahi, the old-fashioned religious Zionism, the Rav Soloveitchik model, which we will, as I said, speak a lot about next class. Let me just begin by saying, what is this religious Zionism that Reines begins to speak about? Settlement in the land of Israel is important. It's necessary. It can bring redemption. But there is nothing messianic about settling in the land of Israel. There's nothing messianic about Zionism. Zionism is a real-world practical solution to the problems of the Jewish people. There's nothing messianic going on here. And we're going to talk in more detail what this means and how this approach differs, not just from Rav Kook's approach, but what has become mainstream American religious Zionism today. There is religious significance to the Zionist movement, but what is it? That people put the land of Israel at the center of their consciousness. But as I said, it's not messianic, it's realistic. In fact, Reines, in a book, he wrote a number of books on religious Zionism, Orav HaSimcha, he writes about how in primitive times, the only way to recognize God was through miracles. But in the future era, we'll be able to recognize God through the natural world. And this then leads him to his view of religious Zionism. I see it's already 10 o'clock, so this is going to take us a few minutes, what his view of religious Zionism is, how it is really pushed asunder, and why it's coming back now among many circles. But we'll need, I don't want to start that now, so we'll end here. What we'll do next class is, first of all, religious Zionism, the Reines model, the founding of Mizrahi. He and Kalischer are the two most important religious Zionist figures, and we'll talk a little bit about the history of Mizrahi, the Reines vision, and how it was usurped. And then, of course, we have to speak more about what happens in Lida with this yeshiva. This becomes the model for Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elchanan. This becomes the model for Bernard Revel in creating his Yeshiva University. And the first great Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University, the Meitzer Tzvi Eloi, comes from the yeshiva in Lida. But we'll take questions now. So there's a lot to do next class. Yes, there is class next week. It's the last of the semester. I will actually be at the Association of Jewish Studies conference on Sunday, but I'll be taking the train back early Monday, so there will be a class. We will also resume, God willing, as Rabbi Kelman says, in February, in which we will begin with Rav Chaim Hirschenstein, and I will then do Rabbi Yitzhak Nisim, Rav C. Pesach Frank, and Rav Shlomo Messas, that's the Moroccan tradition, and Rav Nisim, the chief rabbi, a lot of good stuff. Now, Rav Volozhin was closed because the rebelliousness of the students. In other words, that's the reason the government insisted on the increased secular studies. Ostensibly, the reason that was given was secular studies, and they forced the yeshiva to institute a great deal of secular studies. But they knew that the yeshiva would shut. They knew that the Netziv reluctantly had agreed to basic secular studies, and they knew, and they had people in the yeshiva, by the way, they had informers. They had people writing letters to the government telling them what was going on, and we have this all in Sanford's book. So they, rather than simply shutting the yeshiva down because they said there's rebellious activities going on there, it was more tactful for them to put up this idea that institute secular studies. And this, incidentally, explains a problem that people always had. Why was it only Volozhin that they insist on secular studies? Why not all these other yeshivas? And the answer is that it was only a matla. It was only a pretext to get the yeshiva to close. But the real reason, as we see from the internal documents of the Russian secret police, is that the yeshiva was becoming an unruly place. And if you know Tsarist Russia, when you have people challenging authority and all sorts of unruliness, they don't want that. Close it down. Let them go to other yeshivas. So we can say definitively now, and incidentally, Kamenetsky, in his book, before he even saw these documents, if I recall correctly, he writes about this, and he thinks that was a basic reason for closing the yeshiva. And if I recall correctly, there's another book, Rav Moshe Shmuel Vidoro, who was a rabbi at the time, who also writes about it, and he claims, without knowing the Russian secret police documents, that the reason given for secular studies was a phony reason, that the real reason was that the government didn't like the fact that these Bachrim were running around creating all this conflict. Could it be that it was considered the flagship yeshiva? Yes, it could have been, except now we have the Russian secret police documents, which explain why they thought this was necessary. So I think now there's no question what the reason was. I wasn't really criticized per se for the Weinberg book. I was criticized for publishing the letters of Weinberg to Atlas, because Weinberg criticized certain phenomenon in the Orthodox world. And it was Schneer Lyman who said that it's ironic because this book was published around the Nesivim's volume 1993, a couple years before these letters were published. He said it's ironic because what the Nesiv says is a lot harsher than anything Weinberg says, and no one criticized the family for publishing this. I asked Schneer Lyman, what his position was on all these letters I published, and he said, we don't censor Gedolei Yisrael. I'm not talking about things where Weinberg makes a comment about an individual or something. The only thing we published, not just me, the Torah Mata Journal, they published it. The only thing that were published was comments of Weinberg about phenomena in Orthodoxy, extremism, things of that, not about individuals. And I asked Schneer Lyman, because I respect what he has to say, and he said, and I repeat, we don't censor Gedolei Yisrael. So if the Sridiyesh has a position about what's going on in Orthodoxy, that's something that the world should know about. But it was very controversial. Those who are interested can read the letters to the editor in the Torah Mata Journal afterwards, to the succeeding two issues back and forth over this. And I'll just conclude by saying the great irony is that the same reason people opposed publication of the letters is the exact same reason people thought that it was vital they be published. Just to give you an example, the Sridiyesh is shown there to have a close friendship with someone who's not part of the Orthodox community. So for some people, that's a terrible thing to show that the Sridiyesh has this friendship. And for others, just the opposite. That is precisely why you need to see this. Rabbi Weinberg shows that he has trouble with certain aspects of Jewish law, let's say vis-a-vis Gentiles. He doesn't reject it. He just shows it troubles him. Some people thought this was a forgery, that a Gadol Yisrael could never think this way. And David Berger writes in one of the Orthodox Forum volumes that that is precisely why these letters needed to be published, to show that just because you have questions and problems is not identical with, as Berger says, prikata'ol, throwing off the yoke of the commandments. So the very reasons why people thought you can't have, shouldn't publish this, are the very reason why others thought it needed to be. If those who are interested further, on Torah in Motion, I have a lecture called How to Write a Rabbinic Biography. And in there I discuss the dispute over publishing these letters, my own position, and why in the end we published these letters. And they've been quoted now by many people, and in retrospect, maybe one of the letters shouldn't have been published. You know, it's hard to say, but after the fact, they become very important. Well, in this ceiling, I don't know if you've been in all the classes in this show, because I'm always showing the books that I use. Yes, I have many, many books, although I will say that I stopped buying books, a lot of books, in the last couple of years, because HebrewBooks.org has so many of them, 14,000, and Otsar HaChachma has about 25,000, 26,000. So I don't buy a lot of the standard books, but I buy other books. Look, it's, for me, it's deductible because it's part of my profession, so I can deduct it from my taxes. J.J. Schachter, yeah, he publishes an entire essay explaining why he should publish it, and then in the last he says, but if he was wrong, he has Harata, and he goes to Weinberg's Kever. Look, I don't know if I was right. Really, it has nothing to do with me. I gave him the article. He published it, and he wanted it. I could have been, maybe I'm wrong about some of the letters. It's hard to say. And Rabbi Schachter has a very interesting essay. David Singer wrote about this on the journal First Things. This was the biggest issue of the year in 1997, the Orthodox intellectual world. You know, should these letters be published? Because it raised all sorts of questions about how much should we know about what Gedolim thought, etc. But I go back to what Schneur Lyman said, that we don't censor Gedol Yisrael on ideas. That's what he's referring to. And I don't, although, and I go with that for the most part. There could be an exception if it's a family member who says, I don't give you permission to write it. But not to publish letters because they show Weinberg was friendly with non-Orthodox. You know, one of the other ones that got people very angry, and he said, Weinberg says that these reform rabbis used to go visit Weinberg, and conservative rabbis and others, and he was always very open with them. And he writes to Samuel Atlas about a certain reform rabbi. His name is Kravitz. He's not the one who teaches at HUC. He's another one. No, not Kravitz, sorry, Bemperad, Jack Bemperad, if I'm not mistaken, that's the one. He says that these Reform rabbis that he meets are Achil Hashem. Why are they Achil Hashem? They're Achil Hashem because they show that you could be a mensch, you could be an Ohev Yisroel, you could be, you know, all these great things and not be a Shomer Torah Mitzvos. And that's why it's Achil Hashem, because they show that you can do all these, be a really good person, and not observe Torah and Mitzvah. So what does that say about Torah and Mitzvah? And then he says, and look at all these Orthodox phonies we have who, you know, follow the Mitzvah and are frauds and have no ethical sensitivity. So the fact that he would compare the for me, you know, it makes perfect sense. You know, the Reformed Jews, you know, Weinberg says in a letter to Rav Kook that Hashem, everyone has the chuyos. And that this is, there's a chuyos that, but for some people, that Weinberg could compare even in one aspect negatively Orthodox rabbis to Reform rabbis, that to them was impossible, unheard of. And what can I say? Rabbi Weinberg was a very open-minded person. And for those who haven't read it, you can read it. I will acknowledge that when you read the letters, and this is what Rabbi Weingart, who was one of Weinberg's students, why he opposed the letters, when you read the letters just by themselves, Weinberg comes off as a grouchy, depressed person, and when you read him in the context of the book, Weingart has no problem with them being in the book, unlike other people. He says there you see them in context. When you see them just one after another, and you don't see the context of Weinberg's entire life, they do come off like all he's doing is criticizing, and I accept that. I don't know how to change that, though, because I was publishing a selection of letters. You don't get the same sense in the book. What can I say? I still think they're very powerful letters. Would I make the same decision to publish now, knowing what I know? I believe I would make the decision, but I perhaps would put more context in some of the letters, and or I in the book, I would have longer excerpts of the letters. I will tell you that I have other unpublished stuff, which I haven't published, and I'm afraid of the reaction. So also explosive stuff. So maybe in the future, maybe not. What can I say? Don't fear. Okay. And again, some of it is personal. I did censor, by the way, in the book. I took out personal stuff, which I didn't think was relevant. But I put three dots in. Okay. Maybe another time we'll talk about it. Yeah.
Good night, everybody. Okay, thanks. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Happy Hanukkah, the time we meet till next week.
Yes. Good night.